All right, once again, my name is George, and I'm an alcoholic. And now comes the fourth step. And it says we next launched out on a course of vigorous action. After I took my third step, my sponsor said, the fourth step shall begin tomorrow. I went to Staples, got a couple of notebooks, and started my fourth step. One thing that was pointed out to me was that nothing counts. It says here, nothing counts but thoroughness and honesty. And I said, well, I know what that word thorough means, right? But then I looked it up in the dictionary, and it said extreme accuracy, no omissions. So this fourth step, when I started to look at it like that, I was all in this, you know, this big book step study movement. But how would I know that I was thorough? And so what I actually, I actually wrote two fourth steps. When I first came around, I wrote like two or three pages of run-on sentences and rambling paragraphs. Most of it was sex-related, and I read it to a priest, and I thought that's what a fourth step was. But when I got to this big book step study meeting, I found out that I had no idea what I was talking about. So what I did was, first of all, why do it? Well, number one, it says that alcohol is but a symptom. Now we're going to get down to causes and conditions. So it's in this fourth step and the later steps that I realized why I drank. The allergy that I have to alcohol, I put that in my system and I have to have more. But why do I do it to begin with? And it was in this exercise here that I learned a lot about myself. And also, this was an exercise to try to discover what had been blocking me from this spiritual awakening that I was seeking. So when it says, and also one of the senior members of the group said that the list of names is the foundation for a really good fourth step. So, and it says we went back through our lives. So what I did was I got a 24, 25 column sheet of paper. It's about 3 feet long. And I made a timeline, okay? I went back to my first memory, which was probably about 4 years old. And I broke my life up into, I think, five-year increments. So if you can imagine a long piece of paper in five-year increments, like 5 to 10, 10 to 15, 15 to 20. And in each one of those columns, I wrote down significant places that I was at, the school that I went to, the neighborhood that I lived in, a church that I belonged to, if I went to Boy Scout, whatever. So as I had this timeline broken up into five-year increments, in each of those five-year increments, I had these subdivisions, if you will. Not names, just locations. And then I thought that I would sit and meditate on each one of these things and see if any names came to my mind. So what I did was I went into my bedroom, I shut the door, I got on my knees, and I kneeled over the bed, and I had, like for instance, I went to this place called Waller School when I was like in first grade. So I said I would meditate for at least 20 minutes on that school alone. And then I would sit there, and in my mind's eye, going back many, many years, the kid that sat next to me, this kid stole my lunch, the teacher that didn't like me. So these names started coming out all around that specific place that I spent some time in as a kid. And then when that was up and I couldn't get any more names, I would go to the next little subdivision. So I gave each one of those subdivisions about 15 or 20 minutes. And over about an 18 or 20 hour period, I had a pretty significant list. I was in the restaurant business for 30 years. I had 100 or two employees that I didn't like. I was in the Marine Corps. I was in the Marine Corps. There was a whole list of incidences there. So anyway, this timeline helped me focus. When I started writing, you know, when I first started, I said, oh, yeah, okay, this kid down in first grade, then this person in high school, and I was all over the place. So the timeline was a little tool that I used that I could focus, and I could focus in a specific part of my life, and if nothing came up, then I moved on to the next one. So that's just a little thing that worked for me. And when I was done with that list, then it was the time to look at institutions, things like the IRS, the Motor Vehicle Department, the bank, the post office. The list goes on and on. And when I got through with that list, then it was principles. A principle is defined as a rule, a regulation, or a code of conduct. So in the Marine Corps, there were all kinds of rules. High school having to ask to go to the bathroom and get a little pass. You know, there were all kinds of these things that annoyed me. I think at the end, I had 330 people on my resentment list. I had, I think, 18 institutions, and I think about 12 principals. So when that was done, and my sponsor was checking this as we were going along, when I was done, there was no doubt in my mind that I had not done a thorough job getting that list. So I just passing it on to you. I came to the point where I said to Bobby, I says, man, I am done with this list. There is nobody that I have left out intentionally. So he said, okay, now it's time to do the cause and effects. So the exercise is written right there. So I wrote down the person's name exactly as it is on page 65. And I'm not competing with anybody, please. I'm just sharing my experience. So I had 330 people on that list, and I had 1,200 resentments on those 330 people. Some only had one or two, some I had 20. So I would write down, I'm resentful at Jeff. The cause of the resentment, he gave drinks away in my restaurant. What did that affect my personal relations, my financial security, my ambitions? And then I'm resentful at Larry. The cause of the resentment, he wouldn't let me cheat off his papers in high school. It affects my personal relations, whatever. And so when I got through with that list, I had 1,200. I had 1,200 resentments on those people, principles, and institutions. My sponsors, I was a workaholic as well. 80 hours a week, 6 days a week for 15 years. My sponsor, I said, geez, I don't have time to do this. He said, let me tell you something, George, you always have time to do things you want to do. And that was my mantra. I said, I'll find time to do this if I want to do it. So sometimes I would write for 5 minutes a day. Sometimes I would write for an hour or two. And I made a pact with myself, and I gave him my word that I would write 6 days a week. And it took me 1 year. So just a heads up, if anybody's thinking of doing this, you find time to do the things you want to do. And it was a six-day-a-week job, and it took me a year to write it. So anyway, then comes the invisible paragraph. Back then, they would call it the invisible paragraph, and that's the turnarounds, you know, because many people look, oh, yeah, I did that, no problem. Well, what about the turnarounds, which is on page? Now we're going to look at this from an entirely different angle. So now I've got 1,200 resentments, and I've got to ask myself four questions on each one of those resentments. And my sponsor said, look, this is not any kind of intellectual exercise. We want you to just get right to the nitty-gritty. 8 or 10 words is all we need. So I thought I would just give a turnaround to you to tell you how it was. So I'm going to use Jeff, the bartender that was giving away drinks. So I got a resentment against this guy. And, you know, my old self would say, hey, he's wrong. There's nothing wrong. I didn't do anything wrong here. He's giving drinks away. He's the issue. So then I said, I got to forget about him entirely. Where am I at fault here? So, where am I selfish? Man, I never took the time to check his references before I hired him. You know, I was too busy doing other things. If I had checked his references, I might have seen that he had this issue in other places that he worked. I didn't write all that, but I just wrote, I was selfish with my time and my priorities because I did not check his references. Where am I self-seeking? He was a big, good-looking guy. I like good-looking people working in my business. Where was I dishonest? I was doing the same thing. And where was I afraid? Where was I afraid? I was afraid that he was giving away, you know, money that we desperately needed. So that's an example of a turnaround on one issue. I'll give you another one. So this kid, Larry, incidentally, I went back and made amends to this kid at a family, at a class reunion, which was really good. So anyway, my last name is Lake. His last name was Ladd. So we always sat next to each other all through high school. And he was really smart. And I was partying all the time. So I would be always looking over at his papers, but he would never let me cheat on him. You know? So I had a resentment against him. So I had to write this turnaround. I'm resentful at Larry, causing the resentment he wouldn't let me cheat off his papers. Where am I selfish? Again, I'm selfish with my time and priorities. I'd rather play than study. Where am I self-seeking? Well, if I get good grades, I'll have more privileges at home. Where am I dishonest? I'm willing to put my name on somebody else's work. And where am I afraid? I'm afraid that if I don't get good grades, I'm going to lose privileges at home. So now you take 1,200 resentments times four, you're talking 4,800 applications here. So this part of the fourth step took me about 9 months. Of the year that took me to write, this probably took me about 11 months. And that's the way it went. I'm not going to read any more to you, but you get the idea. So that was the first part of the three parts of the fourth step. And again, I would bring my notebooks to the meeting, which was blew my mind when I first went to this big book step study meeting. I see people bringing in notebooks. Where do you see that at a regular meeting, right? But anyway, I would bring my notebook every week, and my sponsor, 5 minutes before the meeting, he would go through it to make sure I was on point so I didn't waste, you know, go down the road the wrong way. So when the resentments were done, it was time to write the fear part of the fourth step. I don't know if you're anything like me, but I discovered at a very early age that alcohol took away fear. I noticed that in my teens, if I was going to go to a dance, a few beers in the parking lot, I could be more a better dancer. If we were going to get in a beef with somebody, I'd have more courage. So that alcohol taking away the fear was a big reason why I drank. And I also discovered that fear is my second career. I sold vitamins and supplements and heard a lot of doctors talk that fear and anxiety, there's a direct link between fear and heart disease, stroke, and they say that even panic now will kill a person faster than a speeding bullet. So fear is a real, real powerful emotion that we have, and I was riddled with it, and one of the reasons why I drank every day was because I was afraid. I was in the bar business, there was a lot of crowds at night, there was jackpots once in a while. So the alcohol kind of took that fear that I had away from me. It was a very big part of my life was suppressing that fear. So now I got to write my fears. I also remember what Job in an ancient test says, that which I fear I draw to me. In other words, some of my fears became self-fulfilling prophecies. I'll give you an example, or actions that I took and actions that I did not take, I would often make the fear come true. I'll give you an example. I was always afraid that I was going to lose my first restaurant. So you know what I decided to do? Let's open more restaurants. That way we'll make more money and we'll be able to keep the first one. So what did the expansion do? It weakened me financially, diluted my management skills, and the very same thing I feared I made come true, I lost it. I was always afraid of getting a root canal. So I wouldn't go to the dentist till I had a toothache. Have a toothache, go to the dentist, takes an x-ray. Guess what, George, you need a root canal. So the very same thing that I feared I made come true because of what I didn't do, right? Here's another good one. Boy meets girl. Boy's afraid he's going to lose girl, begins possessive behavior, and frightens the girl away. Those are self-fulfilling prophecies based on fear. To me, it was a very, very powerful lesson that I learned. So when I have fear today, I try to deal with it quickly, and I don't mean with alcohol. Either I pray or I call somebody that I can talk about it with. So I'll give you an example of a fear that I had. I had 112 of them, and I had one fear that I was going to get robbed at night. These restaurants that I had were pretty busy, and you know, there's a lot of money in the restaurant before credit cards were as popular as they were. There's a lot of cash. So anyway, I had a fear that I was going to be robbed. So the turnaround is, where am I relying on myself, and what should I do instead? So this fear of getting robbed, I'll give you an example. Where am I relying on self? I'm being preoccupied with something that might not ever happen. What should I do instead? Trust and rely on God for me to use good judgment, you know? So there's a turnaround of a fear of being robbed. another fear that I have, this restaurant opened up not too far from me, and it was a pretty cool place. So I have a fear now that this restaurant's going to do more business than me. So I got to write a turnaround, right? I'm afraid, I'm preoccupied with another person's, you know, skills. What should I do instead? Trust and rely on God to let me be happy with my best effort, you know? So those were the turnarounds. They were short and sweet, and I had 112 of them. I think that probably took a week or two. And then came the sex inventory. And it's not easy for me to sit here that alcohol broke my moral compass. I lived a double life for 17 years. I was in the restaurant business. It's the fast lane. You know, lock the door at 1 o'clock in the morning and the party would start. And the sex inventory is probably the darkest part of my life, one that I'm not at all proud of, but it says we discover and digest some big chunks of truth about ourselves, you know. So anyway, in the sex inventory, I had to list my sexual partners. I had a couple of homosexual experiences at 13 or 14, dinking around out in the woods with other guys, but I think I was heterosexual from the time I was 16, and I've been ever since. But I went to this men's meeting, and I was hearing guys talk about their sexual life, and it was really, I couldn't believe the honesty that I was hearing in that room. So some of the things are not appropriate for co-ed meetings, but it was for them. So anyway, I had to make a list of my sex partners, and I'll just use a generic name of Susie. I hope nobody hears name Susie. But So I got to just find it here. All right, it says, we reviewed our conduct over years past. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate? Whom did we hurt? Da-da-da-da-da. So I had sex with Susie. So where am I selfish? I want sex with yet another woman. Where am I dishonest? I was married. Where was I inconsiderate? We had sex in a car. Whom did I hurt? My wife. I hurt her husband. Did I unjustifiably arouse jealousy? My wife was suspicious of where I was coming home late at night. Bitterness, she eventually found out, and it was part of the failure of our marriage. Whom did I hurt? I hurt my kids. I hurt her family. And what should I should have done? What should I have done instead? I should have passed. You know. So I did that numerous times, and that was my sexual inventory. And when I got through with it, my sponsor said, "Are you ready to write an ideal for a normal sex life?" And I said, "I would." So. My ideal, I wrote a paragraph, an opening paragraph. Dear God, as you know, I'm doing my fourth step, and through prayer, meditation, I'm writing these ideals and ask for your help to follow them up, follow this ideal. I had 28 of them. I listed them one at a time, right? It wasn't a bunch of paragraphs. It was just one at a time, and I wrote a few. Okay. I would never let alcohol or drugs play a part in mine or my partner's sex drive. From this day forward, I would always be monogamous. I would never use money or prestige to manipulate a person into sex. I would be kind and considerate before, during, and after sex. And the last one, which I always remember, was that I would never do anything that I wouldn't also do in the last hour of my life. So that whole exercise took 1 year. My sponsor checked my work along the way. There was no doubt in my mind that I had done a thorough job. I was ready for step five. And I also, there's a thing called the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier in Washington. So there are, unfortunately, servicemen that have been killed at their bodies. They did not know who they were. So they have this, I'm sure many of you are aware of it, they have a tomb that represents these people that they didn't know. So I get chills thinking about that. But I had an unknown person that I knew in my heart of hearts that I did not forget anybody. But I said, I'm going to have a little tomb of the unknown person. So I had one name that was, I just had one invisible person. And I said, I'm sure there's somebody that I did forget, but this will be a symbolic gesture to cover that one as well. So that's my experience on the fourth step. It says that we discover and digest some big chunks of truth about ourselves. In the resentment part, the big chunk of truth that I discovered is, as a man thinketh, so he becomes. And my thinking was not good. And when you fill five or six notebooks of bad thinking, I mean, you don't have to be too bright to get the message. You know? And the second part, the fear part of the fourth step, I realized that, again, my fears often became self-fulfilling prophecies, that if I continue to chew on that fear, I'm going to make it come true. And then the sex inventory, I often wondered, you know, why did they put sex in this? But I realized there were a lot of similarities between alcohol and sex. I put myself in a lot of dangerous situations when I drank, and I put myself in a lot of dangerous situations pursuing sex. I remember getting jumped from behind in a parking lot one night, and I got beat really bad. I lost a lot of self-respect when I drank. I lost a lot of self-respect because of my sex life. And I lost a lot of self-esteem in my drinking, and I lost a lot of self-esteem in my sex life. So there are a lot of similarities between alcohol and sex. And also because of the, my moral compass was destroyed because of my alcoholism. I did not have good judgment, and it cost me a marriage, and it took me a long time to try to straighten that out. I will say that I was married 26 years. The infidelity caused a lot of pain, and I told my ex, it says in here that some people, I can't remember exactly what it says, straight pepper diet or whatever. And I tried to make things right, and my wife and I ended up sleeping in separate rooms, and I was celibate for 12 years because of the damage that I had done from my drinking. One day, I had said to my wife, I said, we sleep in separate rooms, we're good friends, but is this the way you want to live the rest of your life? And she goes, She said, I'll never say you didn't try, but I just don't love you anymore. And we decided to get a divorce. And it was all because of that sexual behavior. So I just want to give you a heads up that I've had some real difficult times because of it. So that's my experience with the fourth step. And thanks for listening.
So the fourth step, so like George, I had experiences with a couple of ones before I got into Big Book. So the first one was, I came into, Chris brought me into a woman's group in the fall of 1995, and they said it was really good to get a temporary sponsor. So I got a temporary sponsor, and we were going to meet, it must have been maybe after I got my 30-day chip, and we met at Friendly's. So I got there a little early, and looking quite well. And I'll tell you now, the reason I wanted to look well was because there was an old boyfriend I dated in college, and I always had this fear I'd run into him, and I always wanted to look my best. So, I mean, that was the driving force. So, you know how Friendly's have the paper placemat? So I figured, I'm gonna write my fourth step. So here I am, and because I wanted to impress her, because it was all about impressing back then. So I wrote down, and I thought I was being so, so honest, because I said, I am manipulative. I don't think I spelled it right, but I said, I'm a manipulative person. And I wrote a few things about why I thought I was manipulative. And so, again, God placed these women, these strong, spirit-filled women into my life, and she came and we had coffee, and I said, I've completed my fourth step. And she said, really, Mary? I said, yep. And I pulled out the placemat, and she said, wow, this is really a great start. Can you imagine that she said that to me? How wonderful that was. She said, you are on your way. And, I stayed with that women's meeting until, it was at night. So my husband said, you're home all day. You're a stay-at-home mom. Why can't you find day meetings? And because it's disrupting. And it was. It was disrupting me going out. And so I found my very first mixed-gender meeting, which was big for me, right? Which I needed to do because I have four children. Two of them happen to be boys. I really need to have a really healthy attitude towards men. And so that's where I met Rosemary, the real gruff girl. And as great as she was in the book, she missed a couple of things, like how we set up the notebook, how we do a turnaround. She just said, I want you to write your story. Because it says we sit down and we tell our story. So I wrote my story, and I brought this book in, and it was a Saturday, and I sat down, and I opened up the book, and she said, oh, close the book. She says, you know your story, tell me. I sat there for 4.5 hours telling my story. And it was wonderful to have, and she smokes. And so she just kept smoking. She never got up. We never went to the bathroom. I just told my story. And, a couple of things came out of it, which was, wanting this, walking in a room and not requiring, not wanting, but demanding attention from all of you. It didn't even matter, man, woman, children, dogs, puppies. You walk in, and that's what I want. I want your attention. I want your affirmation. Because what I discovered is that I was invisible unless you were looking at me, right? And imagine going through life like that. I mean, it was awful. But that's what I gleaned from that experience. So I remember being in Market Basket, and so I had this idea of who I was, right? I'm one of the Charlie's Angels, right? So there's three of them. So I'm summing it up. I'm either, you know, Kate Jackson or Farrah Fawcett, or I'm the other one. What's her name? I forget.
Jacqueline
Smith, thank you. So I'm either the flirty one, the sporty one, or the brainy one, right? So I'm down the spaghetti aisle, I'm walking, and here comes the most gorgeous man I have seen all morning, right? And he's coming. So what did I discover? Well, I was trying to turn my diamond around and hide my wedding band, right? And I'm thinking, well, what kind of woman does he want? I mean, this is how simple and empty I am. And and then it dawns on me that I had just finished spending that time with Rosemary. So I didn't even look at him. And I thought that was a monumental experience for me, right? It was the beginning of connecting that I do exist without some handsome young man looking at me and affirming that I'm worthy. And it was incredible. So everything that we go through, my experience has been, is important, and it prepares you. So fast forward, we're with, I had said my third step. I have my brand new black pen that hasn't written a lie, and I get my first set of instructions. And so the paragraph before, on page 64, where it says we do an inventory, right? And we get rid of things that are unsaleable. Have you ever been in, well, I have like an area in my kitchen, and there was a smell, and I couldn't figure out what the smell was until I sniffed around and found a bag of potatoes. I don't think there is a smell worse than a rotten potato. I mean, even the worst bowel movement my kids made when they were in diapers, nothing compares to that. So she asked me, what was the worst smell? And I told her, and she said, well, this is what we're going to get rid of. The stench, the worst thing in stock and trade. And so I love the fact that God gave me that opportunity. But I never buy a big bag of Maine potatoes anymore. So it says, resentment is the number one offender. It kills more alcoholics than anything else, right? So, and my first set of instructions, and I have it on my, highlighted, is that we list people, institutions, and principles with whom we are angry. And so that was my first set. She wouldn't even let me read anymore. She said, okay, I want you to make the list, and then call me when you're done. So some people number them, but I didn't number them, but I knew there were 50 lines, right? So I have, and I write small with my fine tip pen, and I'm doing lines like this. So I have four columns, and I turn the page. So I kind of know how many people I had. And she said, it doesn't matter. You have freedom, Mary, here. You can start from present day and work back, or you can start from the beginning of life and move to present day. So I was so angry with my husband and my mother that I started with present day. So that's how I began. It was my mother and then my husband. And then I just began to list. And the list flowed. It was just incredible. You know, I was able to get all these people. And then she checked my writing on that Sunday. And she said, you have all these names and then cheerleader next to them. And she said, did you have like a list of all? I said, I hated all the blonde cheerleaders in high school. She said, then just put that as a group. You don't have to list every one of their names. I said, really? We can group people? So bad drivers, I don't have to list every one of them. I can just put a group, bad drivers. You know, because when I was trained to drive, we were thinking about the other person. When you're taking a left turn, you hug the left. And these people that are in the middle of the lane, and, you know, so it was very helpful for me to know that I could group certain people. So the blonde cheerleaders, I didn't have to list them all. I just put them in a group. And then, you know, all along. And like George mentioned, you know, I had 30 resentments against my mother. Yeah. And I had at least 17, if not 20, against my husband. But only a couple against the kids. You know, I have four kids, and, you know, sometimes they irritated me, so I put that down. And then, you know, and then the group of the cheerleaders. And then with the institutions, you know, I didn't have many, but I did have one sponsee that had more principles than people. So I just had to say that out loud. I thought it was just amazing. I said, you didn't have many people, but principles. She hated everything that anyone ever told her. Like, that was really interesting. So you can kind of gauge where you are, you know? So I called her and I said, yep, I'm completed with the list of principals, institutions, and names. And she said, okay. So we met, and she was very good. She modeled for me how important it is when someone calls that you look at your daytime, and she always had her daytime over there, and she would say, okay, we'll meet at your meeting. Because I had started a Big Book Step Study meeting in West Newbury because it was so far to go to, you know, to Linfield. I figured, why not start one in your own church? So we did, and it was wonderful. And so we met, and we started with the name, the cause, and the effect. And so I started, of course, and I put my mother and the cause and the effects. And she said, I want you to look up all these words, right? So self-esteem is how I view myself. So it's always on the list of effects, right? Because I'm part of the resentment, right? Or I have involvement in it. And then we bracket the word fear. And we bracket fear because we're going to learn that fear drives everything. But right now we're not going to talk about it until we get to it. So we're just going to bracket it. I like that. Just bracket it. And then we look at our pride. And it's not, you know, the false pride. And it's not the pride that I'm going to learn about in my step 6 and 7. This is pride about how we take pride in doing something well, right? It's all right. And the same with the ambition. What drives us to want to do something? What gives us that oomph? What fills us with energy and passion? That's my ambition. And then my personal relations. Well, that's always listed because I'm involved with whoever it is that I'm writing about. And then my sex relations. And I said, why do I have to write my sex relations if I'm not having sex? She said, because I want you to think about who you are. You're not just Mary, but you're Mary with ambition. You're Mary with, you know, with pride. You're Mary having a relationship. But you're also a sexual being. And it's going to be a revealed to you later on. So I want you to put your sex relations. I said, all right. And then pocketbook. I said, oh, I'm a kid, you know, with some of these things. How can my pocketbook be affected? And she said, well, pocketbook is making money, spending money, and saving money. It's a whole mindset about money. So I want you to put it down. So I'm very, very obedient with certain things. And so I listed all, they're either 7 or 8 of them for all of these. So I have my notebook and I'm lining it. And I'm listening in meetings, and people are calling this part of the writing the juice. Oh, yeah. Hey, all these people that wronged me, and you know, there was a particular cellular experience that I had writing out my causes and effects. And you know, years later, you know, I would have conversations with my oldest daughter, and she would say, you know, Mom, when I would come home and see the blue notebook on the counter, I knew that I had to tread lightly around you. And I had no idea, you know, like in my alcoholic mind, I thought that the only one I was affecting was myself. And thank God I didn't, you know, all of this didn't come to mind or fruition or to my consciousness, but it came gradually because I was then able to change some things. But and that comes in the in the amends part. So so I get through the juice part, and then we start with the turnarounds. And so I'm trying to think of, you know, which ones I want to share with you. And I thought, oh, I'll do something funny. And when I was going to the bathroom, you know, I'm praying, asking God, and he says, oh, no, I want you to do this one. I said, oh, no, I don't want to do that one. I want you to do that one. So, you know, when we make our list, God and myself wasn't on it. Isn't that odd? And so I ended up writing about myself last because my sponsor said, you know, this is really, you did a really great job, but you didn't add God or yourself. So so I'm going to do the turnaround on myself. So that was the last one that I wrote. So it was Mary. And I had a lot of them because by the end of the writing, right, and the end of looking at the causes, the effects, and then the turnarounds, I wasn't as afraid as I was, even though we hadn't yet got to the fear part of the turnaround. So I was angry at myself that I chose when I was in high school to have an abortion. Right? And so my selfishness is that I wanted to go back in time and do a redo with that. And then I had collected over that year 8 parts of the dishonesty. And it's so interesting, and I use these with sponsees that I have. Usually, most people just say, well, what's the lie you told yourself? But the 8 that I have is, of course, the beginning one is, what's the lie I told myself? What was my motive? Did I express my true feelings? Is it my concern? Was I hypocritical? And there are 3 others, and it'll come to me before I finish. So what's the lie I told myself? That I had no way out, which is not true. There were people in my life at church that if I had gone to, I could have been counseled, right? Did I express my true feelings? Absolutely not. I didn't express this to anyone except the young man that participated in making that child, right? And what was my motive? And this is where the fear that's put in parentheses comes about. What I was afraid of was, you know, what would my parents think, right? Because we lived in a house that everything was about what would the neighbors think. Right? So at such a young age, I based a decision that would radically change my life and the life of that child forever. And the thoughtlessness that went into that decision kind of frames my entire life, the thoughtlessness. But more was going to be revealed. And then the hypocritical part was, you know, if you heard about that in high school, because I wasn't the only one back then that was having that, but that secret was kept quiet, and I would gossip. I would say how awful that is, you know. So the hypocritical part, and my motive was, of course, to just be to be Mary, the girl that my mother had raised, because she raised us with morals, and I could justify this, but that's not why we're here. We're here to, you know, rule out and root and find out where all of this came from, and we'll discover it in the fear, right? And so, what was my self-seeking? Oh my God, what I had to do to, you know, create an opportunity to get to. And there was no Planned Parenthood back then. It was preterm in Boston. And what I had to do, I had to lie about sleeping over a girlfriend's house. I had to lie about where I was going to be that Saturday morning. I had to lie about, you know, why I wasn't feeling well. and, you know, all the lies that were, so I was not only manipulating, I was lying, and I was deceptive, and I created all these different stories, and I brought in other friends that could substantiate. It was just that self-seeking behavior. It was incredible. And then I got to look at my fear, you know, fear of other people's opinions, fear of, you know, not getting what I needed, which was for protection of what I thought, what my alcoholic thinking was, of what was important, and you know, not to cause any shame on the family. And today, when we think about it, right, shame on the family. That was my alcoholic thinking. And so I went through all of the causes and effects, all the you know, turnarounds. And when I did my turnarounds, unlike when I did my causes and effects, I sat in the privacy of my kitchen, right? And I'm at the counter, and I would light a little candle just to remind me that I wasn't alone, because I heard, and I'm not, this didn't come to me. I had to hear someone say at a meeting out loud that they lit a candle, and that represented God, and they needed the flicker of the candle to be reminded that we weren't writing this, that God was writing it, and he was helping us to unpack the absolute worst of us, right? And in order to be recreated, in order to be reborn, we had to look at all of it, all the junk, all the pain, all the wounds. And so I did that, and it was just incredible. Incredible that I had the quiet, the fact that I could be in my kitchen, and I could write it. And I wrote often. I wrote often. And then when I got to, you know, the fear part, it was just amazing. And this is the only time I deviated, because I forgot the black pen. So it was a Saturday, and I was taking my son John to the Northern Essex Community College. They were doing an evaluation. Now, my son John is the only one that, when I was pregnant, I drank with. Went to the, you know, remember, I got baby number two, and then went to the obstetrician, and I said, I don't want any more babies. And he said, you know, just wait and take the pill, and you'll, and I never got my period, and I was pregnant with John. And then I went back to him, and I was like, I'm going out of my mind. I have these two kids, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And he says, have a glass of wine. Well, you know, I didn't know what I didn't know. No one knew about the allergy. No one knew about the compulsion. No one knew about the phenomenon of craving. So, you know, pour yourself a glass of wine. I had this, you know, almost like a prescription from him to calm me down. And probably 4 ounces of a glass of wine occasionally is all right. But that wasn't my story. So my son John was born, and, you know, praise God, there was no alcohol fetal syndrome, but there certainly was some delays. So fast forward, it's now, you know, I'm in 2000, and he's being tested. And so the woman said, you can wait in the cafeteria while we do the testing for him. And so how providential is this, that I am now sitting with myself and my notebook, and I'm going to list my fears. And I had a pink pen. So I began. And, you know, you say the third step prayer that I had committed to memory, and I start with the first fear. And the first fear is rape. And I thought, gee, that's kind of odd, you know? And then fear of any kind of physical harm to my children. And then it just, the list went on and on and on and on. And without, you know, skipping a beat. And there were well over 100 forms of fear, right? And some of them I didn't even understand. But God was going to provide some information. He was going to fill in all the holes. He was going to fill in all of it. And so when I showed her the list, she said, my goodness. I said, do I have to copy it over because it's in pink? And she said, no, I didn't have to copy it over. But because, you know, being, I can be that type, you know, black and white, and there's some gray. There's lots of gray. And God wants to heal the gray. And so we began. And You know, I had blocked out. And so present day, I have lots of information because I read my fifth in 2001. It's now 2019. So I have these 18 years of being open to discovering what went on, right? So when I begin to talk with my sponsor, some of the things came back. So there's a lot of sexual abuse when I was a kid. Began when I was 5, and there was a pediatrician, and the pediatrician did things that pediatricians should not do. And I remember telling my mother when I got home, and she said, oh no, he wouldn't do that. So what happens when a child is invalidated, there's like a split, right? And so that happened. So I was invalidated, not trusting what I experienced and what happened, and my mother saying, no, that didn't happen. And I wish that was the only thing that happened, but there were uncles, there was a milkman, there was my older half-brother. And so what I didn't realize is that all of this information would not be unpacked or revealed right now. I was going to have the next 18 years, of experiencing healing. But what I needed to do was to get rid of what was blocking me from God. So we began with doing the fear turnarounds. And Lisa was great. She would say, now, Mary, everyone has a different way of doing the turnarounds. It only talks about two, you know. Self-reliance and what we can do now, which is trust and humbly rely on God and ask Him to remove the fear of rape or remove the fear of your children being harmed. But I can only give you what my sponsor gave me. So we have 5 questions. The first question is, when did I first have this fear? So when did I first have this fear? Well, when I was a little girl. We'll do people's opinions, okay? That's lighter. So my first fear of people's opinions was when I was in, I was probably in the first grade, and we were poor, or so I thought we were. So I wore my uniform to Sunday mass. I went with my grandmother. It was wintertime because she had her mink on, you know? And I would just, like, roll into the mink. And so I looked around in the pew in the back of me, and there was a girl in her party dress. And she was swishing her party dress, right? And here I am in this blue and gray checkered, you know, parochial uniform. Why I didn't put on a dress, I don't know. But that's the story, and that's what I remember. And so she smiled at me. And I stuck my tongue out at her. Because of the fear of what she might have thought of me in the uniform. And here she is, dressed beautifully for Holy Mass, right? That's when I first had my fear. What did I do? I stuck out my tongue. What do I do today? Well, it's the same thing, you know? If someone looks nice, I can give a dirty look. Or if someone is doing something that causes me to look at myself in a way that is unfavorable, I retaliate. That was my go-to, was retaliation, right? And why did I have this fear? Well, the book tells us because self-reliance failed me. But it doesn't leave me there, right? It says, what can I do today? Today I can trust and rely on this new God that I have that's a breath away and humbly ask Him to remove this fear of other people's opinions and have Him direct my attention to what He would have me be. And so I looked up the word be. My husband is a book guy, and so he collects these books. So we have the second edition of the Webster Dictionary. No lie, it's this big. And it used to be on a podium. So I brought it into the kitchen, and I looked up the word be. And it actually has several meanings. So God may want you to stay. He may want you to go. He may want you to remain. He may want you to enter in. Being can mean a lot of different things. And it's important for me to establish this relationship with God so I know what He wants me to be, right? But it's always with Him. And so once I began to understand that God's going to direct me, then I could just relax. And I could just be. And it was incredible. And that's what began to give me an opportunity to enter into the sex inventory. So with sex inventory, it varies from sponsor to sponsor. So I said to her, I wrote out the pediatrician, I wrote out the milkman, I wrote out my brother Bobby, I wrote out all these uncles that were so inappropriate. I said, is it part of my sex inventory? And she said, no, I didn't have to do that. I did not have to do that if I couldn't do it. And I couldn't do it at that time. So I said to her, okay, I made my list of, and she was so interesting. She said, okay, Mary, you're going to list your all the people that you've had sex with. And it's interesting, if you listen to, there was a Laura Schlesinger, she was a talk show host, and she said, sex begins with kissing. And I said, do I have to list everyone that I ever kissed? And she said, no, but I do want you to add to your list all the people that you flirted with. I said, that's just impossible. I was a flirt from the time I was 6 years old. And she said, okay. How about when you entered AA? I said, again, I would have to list every person that I ever came across. And she said, okay. But she said she really believed that she got this from God. So how about just the people in Big Book? I said, that's doable. So I had the list, and I called her and I said, I have this yearning to write about, you know, what happened, you know, the person I met, what happened, and what it was like, and how it ended. And she said, I'll give you one page on the left side, and then you do the 9 questions on the right-hand side. And I only had to do that for my first 3 relationships. And it was very, very important for me to write about David, because I had to, like, have some clarity, right? So my thinking had begun to shift and change. And so I began to write about David, how we met. And I got to see that, you know, I manipulated that whole relationship. In fact, one of his buddies wanted to date me. But I was, you know, he was the big guy of the group, and that's the one I wanted. And, you know, and I pressured him into, you know, starting a savings account. He was a senior in high school. I wanted him to start a savings account, joint savings account with me, because I thought we were going to get married and live happily ever after. And you know, anyone that's a mother that has a 17 or 18-year-old son knows that that is just not a good thing to do. But I didn't know any different, right? And so I got to see how I reacted and responded in a way that was so alcoholic. And I couldn't have done that just by, you know, answering the 9 questions, right? But I was able to answer them once I completed that. So I went through the whole thing. And so I'll just share a turnaround on myself, because I haven't done this since I was in Brooklyn, New York. So I don't want to, but God said to share it. So I put myself, you know, because she told me I had to list men, women, children, animals, objects, and myself. So I put myself down. It was the last one I did. And so I put myself down, Mary. So I'm masturbating. And so how was I selfish? Well, at 2 o'clock in the afternoon when everyone, you know, all the kids are taking naps, you know, I'm in an amorous mood, right? And my husband's not around. He's at work. And so I thought it was a good idea. So that's how I was selfish. How was I dishonest? Well, I would tell my husband when he came home, and he's in an amorous mood, oh, God, I'm so tired. I worked so hard around the house. I had to cook dinner, you know, do the kids' homework. Oh, go on, you know. And this would go on. So, you know, how did I cause suspicion? You know, when you're not waiting for your husband to have this incredible experience, it causes problems, and I was the main cause of that problem. Now I'm satisfied, right? But the poor guy, he's not. He couldn't understand. And I caused suspicion and jealousy, and and when I got to the end, like, what could I have done instead? And it wasn't until I had a conversation with my sponsor about it, and she said, you know, Mary, this is part of the ideal that you're going to come up with. You know, it takes self-control. It takes other-oriented, you know, being altruistic, thinking of someone else, and not causing suspicion, not causing doubt, not causing all of this. And, it was part of my amends masturbating. And since I did that writing, I've been able to hold true to that, and I do save myself and my husband, and that's an amazing thing. But so when I got to my my ideal, so this is how indoctrinated I was, right? My ideal was that I will have sex with my husband whenever he wants, and that was it. That was the whole thing. And I read it to her, and she said, "And you believe that God gave you this?" I said, "Absolutely, because that's what God would want, right?" So I was at a meeting, and this was at least a year later. We were on the sex part of the inventory, and I heard this woman say, you know, in my sex ideal, I brought it to my partner, and I said, you know, we need to come up with a sex ideal together. And I thought, together? You came up with one? And I thought it was wonderful. So after the Sunday night meeting, I went home, and my husband said, so what step were you guys on? I said, we were on the sex part of the inventory. And he said, oh, okay. I said, honey, I heard this woman speak, and she was amazing. She sat with her partner, and they developed a sex ideal. And he said, so what's yours? And I said, well, to have sex whenever you want. He said, I like that one. And I said, I know you do, but, you know, sometimes I get a little, you know, resentful, and, like, sometimes... it's just what you want. And I said, yeah. And he said, yeah. And I said, can you imagine, picture it, that we both together want to join into this union? Not just, oh, let's have a quickie, or this. It's we have 10 minutes. You know what I mean? And he looked at me, and he said, oh, we're going to write it together. I said, yeah, I'd like to do that. He said, well, we'll give it a try. Fast forward, I'm sharing my experience in Brooklyn, New York, and it's with the Missionary of Charity Sisters, right? And I'll get to that in step 12. But one of the sisters gives me a book called Sex and Marriage, and they put on these workshops for the community. And it's written by Christopher West, and it's called Theology of the Body for married couples. So I got it, and I started reading, and I thought, oh my goodness, this is just fantastic. So whenever there is an empty or a void in an area of my life, I think I told you last night, God sends a person, a book, or both. So here I have a celibate nun giving me this book on sex and marriage. But I had just, you know, shared with the sisters, you know, my sex turnaround. So she probably thought I needed help, and I did, right? So I read the book, and it was about inviting God into the bedroom in a way that is so beautiful and intimate. And I read it, and then I had my husband read it, and then we began to hold hands, and we began to invite God. And I never understood that there was something mystical about a sacramental marriage in the intimacy of your sexuality. And I'm here to tell you that it was incredible. And if it was an all-girls meeting, I'd go into detail, but I am not going into detail because it's a mixed-gender meeting. But just to say that God, when he's invited into every arena of our life, beautiful things happen. He's the creator of our sexuality. And so I had no idea of what he created. And just to end it with this, Pope John Paul II, who did the theology of the body, it was a series of homilies that he had put together. He stated, which I'm really hoping, he said, the state that we will all be in heaven will be a state of perpetual orgasm. Imagine that. I'm not afraid to die. And that's my experience.